Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The man who may have done more than any other to bring American forces to bear in Iraq is now wanted on charges of counterfeiting. His nephew, a point person organizing the upcoming trial of Saddam Hussein, is facing charges related to a murder. Ahmed Shalabi, head of the Iraqi National Congress, was once the darling of the Bush administration. He spoke to the BBC from his exile in Iran.
The charges are not issued by the Iraqi government. They are issued by a judge, a novice judge, who is not qualified. In any event, the charges are ridiculous, they are false, and I'm going back to Baghdad to confront those lies.
Joining us on the line from Baghdad to talk about this and other developments in Iraq is Scott Baldoff of the Christian Science Monitor. Scott, Ahmed Shalabi says the charges against him and his nephew are politically motivated. What are Iraqis saying?
Well, absolutely. The timing of these charges coming out is very interesting to people here. The fact that both Shalabis are out of town, both out of the country at the time that the charges are released, is intriguing. And yet, at the same time, with Ahmed Shalabi, primarily with Ahmed Shalabi, people have been thinking this has been coming for quite a long time. There have been rumors and charges and, in fact, convictions pending against Ahmed Shalabi in a number of countries, most particularly in Jordan for a banking scandal. So the thought is that Mr. Shalabi is getting a taste of the new Iraqi government's desire for justice.
How do these warrants for arrest reflect on Prime Minister Alawi, who was once seen as competing with Shalabi for favor from the U.S.?
Well, Mr. Alawi, of course, is a man who needs legitimacy. He needs to establish himself as a leader, as someone who is outside of any shadow of the U.S. government, but also able to make things happen within his own country. There are a number of people who think that maybe this is a political vendetta, but it couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Hmm. Well, speaking of Prime Minister Iyad Olawi, he traveled to Najaf over the weekend to try to get some control in the fighting there between insurgents led by radical Shiite cleric Muqtada Sadr and Iraqi government and U.S. forces. The last time we spoke to you, in fact, there were bullets whizzing by you in the middle of that fighting. What's happening there today?
Well, in Najaf today, U.S. troops started moving in closer to the Shrine of Ali, where a lot of the fighters are based, and a tank made it within 400 yards of the shrine. Helicopters continue to pound the cemetery nearby, which is the main base of the Mehdi army, but there's no sign yet that anyone is surrendering or giving up the fight. In fact, Muqtada al-Sadr today said that he would fight to the very last drop of his blood. And in Sadr City tonight, there's a curfew with helicopters, U.S. helicopters patrolling the streets. But last night we were there, and the Mehdi army were laying down landmines and IEDs on the road. They were ready for a fight.
Yeah. And we understand that this fighting is particularly gruesome, hand-to-hand. I read one account that said U.S. forces could smell their opponent.
Well, this is very, very close fighting. It has elements of Black Hawk Down. A number of helicopters have been brought down, for instance, and these crews have had to been rescued. Also, Bradley fighters have been immobilized by RPGs. This is very, very capable guerrilla force, and thus far there has not been any indication that they've been able to dent. The U.S. has not been able to dent the capability, particularly in a place like Sadr City, of the Mehdi Army.
Mm. Scott Baldoff, thank you as usual.
Thank you.
Scott is correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from Baghdad.
When Barack Obama captivated Democrats with his speech last month at the party's national convention in Boston, he was running unopposed for the U.S. Senate in Illinois. But this weekend, Republican Alan Keyes announced that he will run against Obama. It's going to be a closely watched contest for a number of reasons. Among them, the Democrats are trying to regain control of the Senate. And the winner will become the only African-American in the upper chamber. Keyes, who ran for the presidency twice, promised his supporters a heated battle.
If you are willing to join me in that fight, to join me with your money, to join me with your work, to join me especially with your prayers, then I will promise you a battle like this nation has never seen.
Well, joining us for more on the Illinois Senate race is Roland S. Martin, editorial consultant for the Chicago Defender, an African-American daily newspaper based in Chicago. Roland, thanks for being with us.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
Well, this is historic. You have two African-Americans running for the Senate. The winner would become the third African-American senator since Reconstruction. How's all this playing in Illinois?
Well, I think it's historic on a technicality. It's not as if Alan Keyes actually came through the primary system. In fact, he was simply chosen versus Barack Obama actually came through the system. So, yeah, technically, it's historic in that sense. It is being played very clearly that the GOP had to bring in somebody who could quickly name ID, who could actually articulate a message to compete with Obama in terms of in the debates and things along those lines. But frankly, it is a fractured party, and for them to actually have to go out of the state to bring in somebody who in the past has opposed individuals coming into states running for Senate office is quite interesting.
I remember a few weeks ago we were talking about possibly Mike Ditka being the Republican candidate. But when Hillary Rodham Clinton moved to New York to run for the Senate, Keyes attacked her. So
absolutely.
What's he saying about his decision now to move from Maryland, his home base, to Illinois to run for the Senate?
Well, of course, as it always happens, you begin to justify the reasons. And so in terms of speaking to the issues from a broad perspective, look, here's what Alan Keyes is going to do. He's not caught up in understanding the local issues here in Illinois. And so, frankly, he is going to be operating a national campaign for a state seat. That's pretty much what he's going to be doing. So he will be speaking about the very broad issues, abortion, homosexuality, the gay rights, the constitutional amendment to protect marriage, all of those different things. So he's not going to be addressing issues that are specific to residents in Illinois. He will hopefully try to rally the conservative base in the state, and hopefully they will then gravitate towards his message. But frankly, he's lost two Senate seats in the past. He's lost two presidential campaigns. It's sort of a Republican effort to say maybe there's a guy who can keep his chin up because we're probably going to lose on November 2nd.
Mm. Well, what about those issues, gun control, abortion rights, and so on? Are those the issues that are uppermost on the minds of Illinois voters at this point?
Well, that's frankly not what we've been hearing. The most important thing is the fact that this state has lost thousands of jobs to manufacturing. And so it is also a very serious issue going on in the state between the fight between business and labor. And so you have those issues. Clearly, the economy is going to be the biggest issue in terms of the loss of jobs. How is he, as a United States senator, going to bring businesses to Illinois? How is he going to address the needs of the collar around Chicago and as well as the concerns in upstate and downstate? And so how is he going to speak to the people on the south side versus the north side of Chicago? He has no understanding of those issues. And so that's what you can expect to hear people ask him on the campaign trail versus allowing him to simply throw grenades at Obama to sort of tarnish his image before he is likely going into the United States Senate.
Well, we just have a couple of seconds left. Does Obama have just too big a lead at this point to overcome?
Absolutely. Too big, and also is a fractured party in the state. So it's not like you have a cohesive unit that's also getting behind Alan Keyes.
All right, Roland, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Roland S. Martin is editorial consultant for the Chicago Defender newspaper.
Well, Republican Congressman Rodney Alexander is running for a second term in Louisiana this November. which would not be headline news if the legislator hadn't switched parties just an hour before the filing deadline on Friday. The conservative former Democrat says he felt he would be more effective as a Republican, but Democrats are fuming, saying his sudden about-face gave them no time to find a strong replacement candidate. Bill Walsh covers Washington for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He joins us on the line from Lake Charles, Louisiana. And Bill, was it a big surprise when Alexander switched parties?
Well, it was a big surprise. Alexander had been courted by the Republican Party some months ago, and when word of that leaked out, he got a lot of pressure from the Democrats in the state to stay in the party, and he said at the time that he was only talking to the GOP and would remain a Democrat. He actually registered as a Democrat earlier last week and came back in and re-registered less than an hour before the filing deadline as Republican. So it was a big surprise to everyone.
There is a Republican already running. Is it assumed that he will beat that Republican for the Republican seat?
Yes. As you mentioned, there's not any time to get a viable Democratic candidate to run against him. So he's about as close as you come to a sure thing for re-election.
And what does this do, by the way, in addition to feeling let down? We're hearing words like coward and turncoat from his former fellow Democrats. But how serious a blow is it for the Democrats in Congress?
Well, you know, I don't think the Democrats really, despite what they said publicly, really expected to take back the House in this election season. I mean, they had hoped to narrow the gap, but it's unclear that they would even be able to do that. So they lose one more seat. I think a lot of people are viewing this as pure politics by Alexander. He says that it was a philosophical decision on his part. He felt that the Democratic Party had drifted too far to the left. He has refused to endorse John Kerry for president. He didn't go to the Democratic convention in Boston.
He also said that the Democrats gave him a hard time for his votes for the war in Iraq and for the Bush tax cuts.
Well, the party did, but that didn't matter in his district. One of several ironies is that he was close to a sure thing for re-election as a Democrat.
How did Republicans greet this switch?
Well, they were overjoyed, as you can imagine. They had their state convention in Louisiana this weekend, and it was the talk of the convention. The unanswered question is, did Alexander get any promises from the Republican Party to make the switch? Some rumors are going around that he has gotten some promises to be on powerful committees like the Appropriations Committee.
And what are people on the street saying?
Some will see it as a blatantly opportunistic ploy and probably vote for him anyway. The fact is, philosophically, he was more in line with the Republican Party than the Democratic Party. So I think at the end of the day, his constituents, while some may be angry at him for what they see as a blatantly political maneuver, won't be too upset. I frankly don't think his votes are going to change very much.
Well, Bill, we should point out that there is a Democratic candidate for his seat. It's Zelma Blakes of Monroe, and she called herself a domestic engineer when she signed up for the race, and not much is known about her.
Well, so little is known about her. The state Democratic Party chairman said he didn't even know who she was. And so I think that was part of the anger, that there is a Democrat in the race, but the party itself doesn't see her as a viable candidate to take on Alexander.
Well, it's a never dull moment in Louisiana politics.
That's true.
Bill Walsh, thank you.
Thank you.
Bill is a Washington correspondent for the New Orleans Times-Picayune.
Just ahead, Texas rewrites the sex ed textbooks. We'll look at what is included and what isn't.
And later, Ralph Nader's uphill battle. Democrats say he's getting a big push from Republicans. Naderites say, among other things, so what?
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's here and now.
As students enjoy the last few weeks of their summer break, Texans are debating what teenagers should be taught about preventing pregnancy and the spread of sexually transmitted diseases. Four new textbooks are up for review. Three of them teach abstinence only. The other makes only fleeting mention of condom use. And since Texas is the second largest market for textbook publishers, chances are whatever textbook is adopted there will be sold to other states and could remain in classrooms for about 10 years. We're joined on the line by Samantha Smoot, president of Texas Freedom Network, and Kylene Wright, president of Texans for Life. And Samantha, I want to start with you because your group thinks that abstinence only is not the way to go. Why so?
We're deeply concerned about these books, especially in a time when our state, Texas, leads the nation in birth rate among teenage girls aged 15 to 17, and HIV rates among young people remain so high. We do think that abstinence is the best policy for avoiding pregnancy and disease, and the books should stress that as they do. But there's just no question about the fact that teens and their parents need reliable information to protect themselves from lifelong consequences like unintended pregnancy and HIV.
And Kylene, why does your group think that the message of abstinence is enough, certainly particularly given the high pregnancy rate there?
Well, first of all, this is health class. This is separate from sexuality education. This is not meant to be a comprehensive sex ed class. We certainly believe that parents should have all kinds of information and should have the rights to disseminate that. But that this is health class. This is not intended to be a sex ed class. This is much ado about nothing.
Samantha, does it make a difference in your mind that this is health class and not sex ed class?
Absolutely. You know, some districts have sex ed classes, some don't. But the point is that we do have a statewide curriculum here in Texas, and it's a conservative curriculum, but it does say that students should be able to analyze the effectiveness and ineffectiveness of various forms of contraception, including how well they're able to prevent HIV and other STDs. We believe that it's actually inaccurate and extremely dangerous and irresponsible to tell teenagers that the only way to prevent pregnancy or disease is abstinence. And as one book now does, to say things like there's no difference between protected and unprotected sex.
Kylene?
Well, of course, there isn't a whole lot of difference between protected and unprotected sex in teenagers.
That's an outrageous statement, Kylene.
Well, Samantha, I wish you had children. Do you have children? Do you have teenagers in your home?
I don't have teenagers in my home, but please.
You can't know firsthand the way I do and the way so many parents do who want the right to choose for their kids, that teens aren't responsible. They are not fully grown. They are not fully disciplined. They don't make their bed every day. They're in another world 50% of the time. And that's why STDs are so high in their group and why they don't use condoms consistently and effectively, if they work. And it's why they have such a high failure rate in birth control, because
Kylene, they aren't able
to use them consistently.
Let me ask you, Kylene, what do you say that the failure rate of condoms is among teenagers?
Well, I can tell you what the Teen Wire says the failure rate is, and I can tell you what different studies show them.
Kylene, I've heard you say that it's 70% failure rate.
Well,
again,
there is a study from 1995 that says that.
It's misinformation, and it's.
Please don't interrupt me.
It's dangerous.
It says, please don't interrupt me, that when unmarried teenagers live together, when obviously they're having sex more frequently, they have failure rates in the first year of up to 70%.
So let me refocus this a little bit. Both groups would like to see these high teen pregnancy rates go down.
Oh, absolutely.
And the issue is, how do you
get
there?
And they have been going down every year since we started promoting abstinence in the 90s. They're not going down as fast as we would like. Of course, we do have a very large border with a country where the culture does encourage women to have their babies very young. And that is something that we are working on and we are addressing. If you look at the states that do have high pregnancy rates, they are the border states.
Samantha, to the point about the supplemental materials that are available for students, which do include information about alternative methods of contraception, that's not enough?
First of all, only a couple of the books even have those supplemental materials. But the truth is, Gail, those supplemental workbooks will not see their way into very many classrooms. This information is important enough to be in the Texas curriculum. It's important enough to save lives, and it ought to be in the textbooks.
So to you, Kylene, abstinence as a message to teenagers works.
Absolutely. There are studies to back that up. We do have more kids now who are abstinent than who are not, with only a modest stab at teaching abstinence. But where we have condom programs, we just have skyrocketing STD rates and not a whole lot of proof that they work on anything except HIV and gonorrhea.
All right. Samantha, what's going to happen if the textbooks are approved? Will you folks file suit or what?
Well, my organization doesn't engage in litigation, but I wouldn't be surprised if somebody else did. There is a suit pending against our State Board of Education because they rejected an environmental science textbook a few years ago. They felt that because it had information about global warming and industrial pollution, that it was anti-Christian and anti-free enterprise. And I really hope that they'll do the right thing this time.
And Kylene, how far will you folks take it?
Well, we believe that the board will do the right thing because we have used the democratic process to elect these people, and they are accountable to the parents. These books did pass a review panel. There was no sleight of hand, and they were approved by the review panel, and they will be approved by the board, and we will be happy with that.
All right. We'll have to leave it there for now. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Gail.
Samantha Smoot is president of Texas Freedom Network, and Kylene Wright is president of Texans for Life.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Today is the day independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader must collect enough voter signatures to get on the ballot in Maine. This Wednesday is the deadline to gain access to the ballot in New Hampshire and Montana. So far, Nader has qualified for the ballot in just 6 states. Over the weekend, he failed to get enough signatures for California. Nader supporters complain that Democrats are targeting and discouraging potential petition signers. Nader critics say Republicans are helping Nader qualify in an attempt to derail John Kerry. Well, we're going to speak to both sides. Joining us first is David Jones, president of the NaderFactor.com, one of several anti-Nader groups hoping to stop the Nader campaign. David, the Nader campaign says groups like yours are running a dirty tricks campaign just to keep him off the ballot. Your thoughts?
The sad thing about what's happening now is that Ralph Nader is accepting financial support and assistance from the very same corporate Bush supporters that he attacks in his speeches and press releases. He's knowingly helping the Bush reelection effort. And I'm sure all these Bush supporters are not collecting signatures for Mr. Nader because they actually want to make Ralph Nader the president.
Well, but there's nothing illegal with Republican supporters, and it's been reported in Michigan and West Virginia that actually party members have been out collecting signatures for Nader, for Ralph Nader. There's nothing illegal about that.
No, there's nothing illegal about it, but it certainly is hypocritical and cynical on Mr. Nader's part. And even on Saturday in New Hampshire, the Portsmouth Herald reported that David Carney, a Bush supporter there, organized a number of Bush volunteers to help Nader get on the ballot in New Hampshire. They showed up at a rally for President Bush to get signatures to help get Ralph Nader on the ballot. Obviously, they didn't do that because they wanted to make Ralph Nader president.
What's your biggest fear? How serious a problem do you think Ralph Nader's campaign is for John Kerry?
I think Ralph Nader is a serious problem because in this election, clearly, all you have to take a look at is the polls around the country in a variety of states, in Oregon, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, in Nevada. All it takes is a few electoral college votes to swing this whole thing to George Bush, and Ralph Nader has the potential to do that.
David, do you worry about a backlash from Democratic voters? I'm looking at an article where one voter says she resents the Democrats trying to suppress Ralph Nader, and that's why she's going to back him.
Well, I think that if she would take a look at the issues, she'd see that this particular voter has a lot more in common with the Democratic Party than she does with the Republican Party. I mean, the Democratic Party has every right to challenge Nader's ballot. Nader should get on the ballot legally and on his own. The problem is Nader does not have enough support around the country in these various states to get on the ballot on his own. So what he is doing knowingly is turning to Karl Rove, Ken Millman, and a variety of Bush supporters for their help. And
right. Well, some would say, David, some would say that he's not turning to them for help, that they are coming in with help.
Both. I would say both things are happening. In Michigan, he accepted 40,000 signatures from the Michigan Republican Party.
David, one last question. Another thing that Ralph Nader says is that Democrats should be happy that someone's going all over the country taking apart their opponent, meaning President Bush, but instead they're employing dirty tricks to keep us off the ballot. Isn't there something to that, that Democrats should welcome his criticism of your opponent?
I think Democrats would welcome his criticism of President Bush if he wasn't running.
David Jones, president of the NaderFactor.com. Well, joining us now is the spokesperson for the Nader campaign, Kevin Zeese. Kevin, what's your response to charges from David and others that Ralph Nader is being put into office by Republicans as a means of beating John Kerry?
A lot of nonsense. We're collecting almost all the signatures being collected for the Nader Kamau campaign. Mostly volunteers are doing so. We're running on an agenda that challenges the Bush administration and challenges John Kerry to take some progressive positions, particularly on withdrawing from Iraq, providing health care to all Americans. John Kerry's plan would leave 30 million without health care, and challenging George Bush on his whole range of policies.
But Kevin, David Carney, who's a Republican strategist, he was in the first Bush White House, he is on record as saying that his company, Norway Hill, offers a dollar per signature drive to any Republicans who can collect names for the Nader ballot drive in New Hampshire. He's just one of the many Republican operatives.
Whatever he does on his own. He's not working with us. In fact, we're collecting enough signatures on our own. We don't need their signatures, don't want their signatures. We prefer them and the Democratic Party stay out of this process. We're actually more concerned with the Democratic Party because they've been doing dirty tricks across the country to try to keep us off the ballot, challenging our petitioners, harassing our petitioners, sending their corporate law firms to litigate issues and find some kind of technical legal error to keep us off the ballot. That's much more disconcerting because that takes away the vote from the voter and tries to resolve this through harassment and legal technicalities.
But are they doing anything illegal?
That's a bigger problem for our democracy.
Are they doing anything illegal?
Well, that remains to be seen. There are some questions. For example, in Illinois, they use state fund, employees paid on the taxpayer dollar to go through our signatures and review them while being paid for by the state. That certainly raises lots of legal questions.
But isn't that what every candidate has to go through who's doing a ballot drive?
Unfortunately, they're doing much more than what every candidate goes through. There's never been a situation before where corporate law firms are being used to go after ballot access laws. It's undemocratic, and it shows a lack of confidence in their candidate.
But, Kevin,
that's
as you well know,
the Democratic Party, they should be – John Kerry, when Ralph Nader announced, John Kerry said he wasn't worried about it. He would take Nader's voters. If that's the case, then back off. Tell his underlings to back off, let us on the ballot, and challenge us on the issues. Don't run away from us and hide behind legal technicalities.
But, Kevin, as you well know, many Democrats are angry. In fact, a Nader a signature gatherer was apparently attacked in Harvard Square here in Cambridge. People say Ralph Nader caused the Democrats to lose the White House in 2000.
I'll tell you what made the Democrats lose the White House in 2000. The Democrats. Well, Democrats had held their base. They'd be in the White House today. You had Vice President Gore not even able to win his own home state or Clinton's home state. They don't deserve being in the White House with that kind of record.
Well, in this election, according to pollster John Zogby, Ralph Nader now makes the critical difference in every battleground state. Even staunch former Nader supporters, Bill Maher, Michael Moore. Michael Moore and Bill Maher got down on their knees on a July 30th Bill Maher show and begged Ralph Nader to get out of the race.
That was such a stick. You know, they'll see the reality in the end. The reality in the end is they are supporting, it's amazing for Michael Moore particularly, to be supporting a war candidate, someone who voted for the war, who's someone who will keep the troops in the occupation for 4 years, someone who says he will keep the troops there longer than George Bush. That's what Michael Moore's supporting. It's hypocritical and it's embarrassing. He supported a General Clark in the primaries. Clark lost. I don't think John Kerry wants Michael Moore's support because it looks like the kiss of death.
Kevin Zeese, thanks so much.
All right, thank you very much.
Kevin Zeese, spokesperson for independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader.
Still to come, a new film details the real-life story of a South African cop turned bank robber. We talked to director Bronwyn Hughes about her movie, Stander.
You're listening to Here and Now.
At a conference of minority journalists last week, President Bush went on the record for the first time in opposition to legacy admissions, or college admissions for children of alumni, which many see as preferential treatment. President Bush, as well as his grandfather, his father, and daughter, all attended Yale University. As a Yalie, the president was a C student. Here's how he responded to a question about whether colleges should get rid of legacy admissions.
I think so, yeah. I think it ought to be based upon merit, and I think it also be based upon... Yeah. And I think colleges need to work hard for diversity.
Boston Globe columnist Derek Jackson was at Unity, the conference for minority journalists, and he joins us on the line. Derek, welcome.
Thank you, Gail.
Can you describe that moment for us? It sounds as if it was pretty charged.
Yeah, it was a pretty amazing moment. For many people who have followed the affirmative action debate, legacy admissions have stuck out as a potential point of hypocrisy in the drive by many people to get rid of affirmative action for African Americans and Latinos.
Well, because essentially the argument is that legacies are affirmative action for white people.
That's right. Because of the way the country's economics have historically worked out, the overwhelming beneficiaries of legacy admissions are white Americans.
Now, this is an issue that the president has not had to address before, notwithstanding the fact that the administration did file a court case on affirmative action at the University of Michigan. Why has he not been asked about this before?
Probably he's not been asked it because he's not been confronted with a press corps that, by its nature, is terribly interested in the question. At Unity, the Unity folks issued a survey that found that 90% of the Washington press corps is white, which is way over the percentage of white Americans in this country. After he gave this, I went back over press conferences shortly after the administration filed its brief on behalf of white students in the Michigan affirmative action case, and this issue just never came up.
Now, remind us, the University of Michigan case said that race could be considered as a factor, but not too heavily weighted in admissions. Is that right?
So it threw out the undergraduate program because it was too much of an arbitrary factor, but maintained it for the law school because the law school was much more particular in using many factors. And at the time, it came out as sort of a relief, sigh of relief from affirmative action advocates that affirmative action still could be used if done more carefully.
So first time he had to confront it directly. But as you write, several universities, including Harvard and Duke, are very much in favor of legacy admissions. Reason?
Money. It's just as simple as that. College loyalty translates into alumni dollars and continued access, and alumni dollars also involves sort of an assumed access for your children and grandchildren. So legacies are going to be a very difficult issue because you're going to have a very powerful lobby for it, even though the statistics are clearly unfair. I mean, Harvard, Penn, Ivy Leagues, Notre Dame, admitting legacies 2 to 4 times higher rate than a regular applicant.
Derek, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Derek Jackson is a columnist for the Boston Globe.
Stay with us. The story of a real-life South African Robin Hood coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
In the world of truth being stranger than fiction, here's a story you'd think could never really happen, but it did. In the 1970s, a frustrated Johannesburg police captain named Andre Stander lashed out against the status quo in apartheid-torn South Africa and became a legend. After killing a young black man during a riot in the townships, Stander, as he's commonly known, decided to get back at the police force for cracking down on the townships and neglecting the cities.
Where the hell is everyone? They've all been called up, you know, that bomb in Soweto. They have to enforce a curfew. You know a white man can get away with anything today? While the police are too busy washing the blacks!
Well, Stander proved exactly that point by robbing banks, 26 of them, in disguise, while still a police captain. His story has now been made into a feature film, also called Stander, and director Bronwyn Hughes is in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
This story really is just almost too astonishing to be true, and yet it is. He robbed 24 banks without getting caught. Still working as a police officer, eventually went to prison, got out, and then robbed 20 more. What was your reaction when you first read this script? You must have been just fascinated turning the pages.
Yeah, I read the script not knowing anything about the story at all. It was just brought to me as a potential project among others. And in the first 10 pages, there's a sequence which is the township uprising, the riot scene. And on the page, it was, I don't think I was breathing. I think I was holding my breath just to read these words, and the prospect of making that as a dramatic scene was, you know, delicious. So I kept turning the pages thinking, well, it's an apartheid movie. And then a few pages later, it's like, oh, it's a robber movie. And then I turn a few more pages and I find out, oh, it's a cop movie, not a, you know, and it kept throwing curveballs. And so by the end, I realized I'd never read a story anything like this. And the fact that it was true was just mind-blowing.
Well, and for those of us who remember those days, seeing the news film out of the townships, you really do capture it. It looks almost like a documentary, and yet it's a feature film.
I took that sequence very, very seriously. There's an enormous weight on it. One weight is that if we didn't feel anything for Andre Stander in that scene, we wouldn't care what happened for the rest of the 2 hours. So there's the creative weight. Second of all, there was the production weight. It was 1,300 extras and cameras in a scene that can't be rehearsed and can't be shot as a master and involves everything from real attack dogs, not movie dogs, to gunfire and tear gas. And the third weight for myself was that I was, of course, looking into the eyes of the people who'd lived it, all of them, and it only ended only a handful of years before, you know, apartheid. So I felt this responsibility as an outsider to do it justice or to get it as right as possible. And I thought, well, I have to distill this into a single dramatic scene, but I will try and infuse it with as many human details as I can so it doesn't become just a montage of generic chaos.
And also, even when we see him standing there in his riot gear, he is not an unsympathetic character. You see bits and pieces of his background, and particularly when he goes and talks to his father's explanation about how many South Africans looked at justifying the violence in the townships. We have a clip of that.
If you hadn't shot him, what then?
Riots would continue, sir.
And then?
Maybe they would take power. Eventually they will.
They would kill us. Those of us who stayed, wouldn't they?
Maybe they're not like us.
This country would become like the rest of Africa. Impoverished, disease-ridden, corrupt. popular leaders who murder their own people, steal millions from the treasury, and then go off to die of cancer in Swiss clinics. Our blacks have the highest standard of living on the continent. Son, you help the Africans today.
And murdering unarmed men. Unless you call this a weapon.
And then he holds up his fist in the film, if you call this a weapon. Why do you think Stander felt such guilt about killing this young, unarmed black man when his father found it pretty easy to justify what they were doing?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that the visceral experience of being a part of that machine is traumatic. At least that was Andre Stander's own defense on the stand and what he would talk to Alan Hale about. Alan Hale was one of the other men he met in prison that he busted out with, and they went on a spree together. Alan Hale's still alive, and he told me that the penny dropped for Andre during his time on the riot squad. And I think you have to consider that he'd been brought up in a world, in a household, very protected kind of world, that taught him that everything he was doing was for the right. He was part of the chosen people in service of his country, in the name of duty, his father being a respected police general. And it was like coded behavior, and nobody asked questions from the outside. And then the moment he becomes the murderer in the name of duty, everything he's been taught to believe, I think, is upended. And it would have been easy to make the father a monster in this film. It sounds completely crazy to us, his logic. But really, I think you need to take a step back from your upbringing in order to see what it really meant.
And then at the same time, there's this sequence of car chases and robberies, and you know, there are so many elements in this film.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's the thing. We've set up the movie. We're talking about the very, very heavy place that the movie begins, and the time and place is very complex. But in fact, what happens with Andre Stander is he crosses a line. He starts robbing banks and realizes that there's no turning back, and he gets on this wild ride, and then he gets good at it, and then he gets fed by the adrenaline pump and keeps upping the ante and making the establishment look bad, you know, and becomes a popular hero. And the thrill ride of it is kind of the journey that the film takes you on. And I thought I made a dramatic movie. It actually is funny.
Do you mean we've been robbed by Andre Stander?
Yes, sir.
Hey, we've been robbed by Andre Stander, eh? Andre Stander! Oh, that's something, eh?
Tell me about the man who plays the lead character here.
Thomas Jane plays Andre Stander in a performance that I hope people are going to take note of. At least they are so far starting to talk. He's been in many films that you've probably seen and maybe not even realized it's the same guy, between the handlebar mustache guy of Boogie Nights, who goes off on Alfred Molina, to Original Sin, very strange character. And he's in Last Time I Committed Suicide and Deep Blue Sea, and he plays Mickey Mantle in 61, you know. And I'd seen most of those things, but then someone proposed him for the role, and I said, well, you know, who is he? And they brought me his reel, and side by side, all of those things added up to an actor who could so physically and emotionally throw himself into a role that he became these different people, the ultimate chameleon, more or less. And as I researched Andre Stander and heard people describe him, it seemed as if that match was perfect, that Andre Stander could become whoever he needed to be in a given situation.
You spent months and months in South Africa working on this film. What is your sense of the country's future at this point? Are you optimistic about where they're heading?
Yeah, it's a fascinating place. I thought I knew a thing or two until I got there. It's chaotic. There's an enormous problem with violent crime, home invasions, carjackings, robbery. Terrible, terrible things going on, all of which is in the international news. And yet, there's so much more. I was working with a location scout, an Indian South African guy named Morgan, who said, you know, everybody's saying that this place is so violent, but I see it different, he said. He said, now it's a democratic form of violence. It's the gap between the haves and the have-nots, and if you get robbed, there's a kind of logic to it. It could happen to anybody, as compared to before, when it was a government-sanctioned form of violence and no escape, no one to turn to. So in that sense, that's a massive improvement, especially for an Indian South African, you know, a colored person. I was really, really impressed to spend so much time in the townships where, you know, the scenes in the film of these slums made of, you know, found bits of tin and broken bits of wood. I didn't dress it for the movie. That looks like now. This is in the new South Africa. And the thing is that, of course, when Mandela came to power, things fundamentally changed, but a Cadillac didn't pull into the driveway of the people in need, you know. And so you would look at this in terms of material wealth, and you think, my God, these people are there's no hope, and there's so many of them. But yet you'd start talking to people, and you'd sense a kind of optimism among them, a sense of community, common purpose, art, music, dance, spirit, everywhere you look, and you think, this is possible. This is transitioning before my eyes. And, you know, it gives you great faith that even out of that chaos, something good could happen.
Bronwyn, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Director Bronwyn Hughes talking about her new film, Stander.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.